Welcome to MedShark Insider with Bill Fukui, your expert host on all things medical marketing and SEO.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of MedShark Insider. And I am really honored today because not only do I have a friend on the line, but somebody that I told her when we first met a while back that I saw her from afar and I was like always intimidated by her because she was like this larger than life personality when it came to credibility in terms of marketing, medical practices, speaking at conventions. And I have the luxury of having Dana Fox on today's show. And I wanted to, for those that don't know Dana, she is a longtime veteran and have been in the business as long, probably longer than I have, which there's not too many of us that's been out there that long, but she's kind of been able to move with the times. And that's one of the things I've always liked about Dana was she always is very adaptable to changes in the marketplace. And so today we're going to be talking a lot about changes that we've seen over the course of time as it relates to branding and referrals and keeping patients. So I want to welcome Dana. Dana, could you do a little introduction for yourself and let people know that don't know you a little bit of background on yourself, and welcome today.
Thank you so much, Bill. And that was quite an introduction. And yes, when the earth was still cooling, I started my first marketing business in the plastic surgery arena. So I have been an industry consultant in that area for about 30 years. And of most recent things that I'm excited about is the American Society of Plastic Surgeons has asked me to write a second book on a brand apart. With Dr. Greg Evans, who's past president of ASPS, and that will launch in October at the ASPS annual meeting.
That's great.
I think in Atlanta.
Congratulations, Dana.
Thank you. Thank you. Very excited about it. It's a real honor, and I think probably the reason for that is that I haven't made too many enemies. You know, it's hard to be in an industry for a very long time and not make mistakes and so forth. And so, and I think practices probably experience some of that themselves, mm-hmm. that when you start a medical practice in the beginning, you have a very different idea of what it's going to look like than 5, 10, 15 years later, right. as a mature doctor in a mature practice. And so it's the same with me as a professional marketer.
Well, Dana, you have had great experience, and one of the things, and this was, we just had this conversation maybe last week, was a lot of the changes that we've seen over the course of time. I mean, we were marketing, you know, cosmetic and plastic surgery back in the days when you were pretty much limited to traditional media, or yellow pages was pretty much, you know, what your options were. So branding is, you know, used to be a very different animal back then as when we say branding today, it is very different. And especially with the internet and, you know, with digital, social, all those types of things. What would you say in terms of, you know, this whole idea of what is the role of branding today for a plastic surgery practice, whether they're a new practice or one that's been around, but really never invested in, quote, a brand?
You know, those are great questions, Bill. And I was thinking about, reflecting about what you said in terms of how branding has changed. And I would say that branding in its actual definition hasn't really changed. What has changed are the mechanisms, the delivery systems, mm-hmm. with how we provide information to the public, or specifically to the demographic that a specific practice is trying to reach.
Great point.
I think that's different. But what I think is fascinating about this is when you mentioned Yellow Pages, it was nothing for a surgeon or a dermatology practice or any kind of an aesthetic practice to spend 50, 75,000, 100,000 on just Yellow Pages alone. And then if you add billboards and you add radio and so forth, and in the very beginning of the sort of the internet stage, if you will, it was nothing for practices to spend $50,000 a month on a directory site. So definitely physicians have always spent quite a bit on marketing, but where branding comes in, and I think this is probably the most important thing that I could share with any of your viewers, is that branding is not just a logo. It's really the messaging about who you are, what you believe in, what are your products that you're selling that might be different than some of your competitors, or even if they're the same product, your approach might be different. So I find that physicians don't spend enough of the downtime really thinking about who they are, how they might talk about themselves in different terms. So I think that's where branding comes from. And it's from the words of the vision, if you will, of the doctor or the team of doctors that guide what the branding is actually going to look like in the printed word and in the visual presentation.
I think you brought up, you know, the one point that I, you know, that sticks with me is number one, branding hasn't changed. It's still the fundamentals of that has changed. It's the delivery or the channels in which those messages are being crafted and delivered. The other thing would be this idea of differentiating what makes you different, unique, you know, those types of things. And I think with, you know, the internet today, we're talking about even on certain platforms, they're called stories, and stories are story for a reason. It's you know, part of this is an opportunity to really tell a practice's story, who they are. I was on the phone literally before we got on today with a practice out in Indiana, and I know that practice really well. And I said, you know what? I look at what you guys are doing, and what you guys have here is not what I'm seeing online. You know, it's not being translated. Everything here is stock photography. Everything is, you know, I don't know, kind of generic content and stuff. I said, man, you guys, what you guys have here is so unique. None of that really, I don't see that when I come to your website. So I think there is a, you know, when you're talking about branding, how can you do that to the other thing would be a niche audience. Is you don't need to be a Nike to the rest of the world, but you do need to have a brand to a you know, that target audience that you've identified.
Some of the questions that you had provided for me for our conversation today, so that I could at least be sort of thinking about them a little bit, was how do you sort of establish what you're going to be marketing? And I think this is one of the stumbling blocks I see for a lot of doctors, especially in the aesthetic world, where now you can do so many things. It isn't really just surgery. It isn't just skincare or peels. It's sometimes dozens and maybe multiple dozens of procedures and products. And so when a practice is trying to decide, well, what exactly am I going to market? They want to actually market everything. And I think that's a real stumbling block, a real problem, because then you become known as a generalist. You don't become known for anything specific or anything that you can really hang your hat on and say, boy, I am really an expert in this area. Mm-hmm. You can do everything, of course. You can do all the procedures and everything that you are able to do and trained to do, but it's what you market that will really differentiate you, and honing that in, making it a narrower presentation is going to be much more effective. You'll get there much faster by only marketing 3 to 5 things that you actually do and doing it really well. I think that's really the difference.
You know, now that you've kind of jumped right into this whole idea of how a practice can start, you know, formulating their own brand, which I think is really the goal of this show today, is to give people some insights. when you're working with a client in terms of branding, how do you get them to narrow down those things? Because there's so many, you know, what I call eye candy. There's so much stuff that all these vendors and everything's dangling in front of doctor machines that they're selling, technology that they're selling. Now they're trying, and they're trying to sell everything to everybody. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to do that. How do you talk to a practice and get them to focus in on the things that they need to? And how do you start that process of developing, you know, that, you know, it's kind of esoteric. What is a brand, and what, how do you communicate that concept right to a practice?
No, I think that is the perfect question for this. In fact, it's one of the chapters that I'm working on right now for ASPS, is when you look at how physicians market themselves, because for the most part, they're scientists. So they think in terms of facts and figures and in the details, but it's not how consumers buy. We buy for emotional reasons. We don't buy for the facts and the figures, even if we say we do. Even for the analytical person, there's still an emotional trigger that says, this is the product, this is the car, this is the house. It triggers something in us emotionally, and that's why we buy it. So when you think about physicians really honing their message, you need to sort of put your feet in the shoes of the consumer. Why is it that they want to have a specific product or service or outcome? And really thinking about that. But let me come back to something else that I sort of failed to mention. You asked how I do this. And when we work mm-hmm. with a client, we spend a lot of time up front. And sometimes they push back on that, go, oh, I don't want to spend the time. And actually the time that we spend up front, that hour and a half interview of really talking to you, really finding out what motivates you, what drives you, what are you about as a person, as a physician, as a father, as a husband, whatever the elements are. And then from that information, we find the gems or the jewels that you will, that can be quotes or that can be built into an actual messaging for you. Really hone in on, this is how Bill Fukui is unique among all of the others in Denver. So without that, it's flat. And you see it in hundreds and hundreds of websites. They start with a box, they start with photos, they start with a color palette, and the rest is just also known as. Right. You know, it just doesn't do anything to differentiate you. So start with the content first. In fact, that's one of the things, you know, I'm no longer really in the internet marketing field, if you will, but in writing about the internet historically, which is what we've been doing for the book, is that internet marketing is going to change from week to week, day to day. Anything that we thought was gospel 2 or 3 years ago is no longer the case. The only remaining thing that is constant and that I really don't see changing is content. Because the only reason that someone types something in when they're searching for something is it's written and it's what they're looking for. So if the content is really fully developed, whether it's in a brochure, it's in a loyalty program, or it's on your website, that's the most important thing. And the visual elements will change over time. Color palettes change every 5 years, according to the International Color Council.
Right.
People buy new furniture and new carpeting because their colors are out of date. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing for your website and your brochure. But mm-hmm. who you are doesn't really change that much. Your mission, your core values, why you're special, that doesn't change so much. It can evolve, but it doesn't really change that. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's a great point. And it does, and you're right, it does change. And it needs to change simply because even like logos, I think when you say branding, I think what immediately comes to somebody's mind in most practices is our logo. And they always associate branding with our logo. But it is much more than a logo, and your brand doesn't really change that much, but many times your logo should. I see a lot of logos out there that probably should, it's sending the wrong message. It's sending the wrong message than what they become. That right. was a logo that they created a long time ago, and they're, it's just our brand. And I think they're kind of getting fixated on something that really isn't their brand.
Or they're fixated on an icon.
Yes.
And the icon itself can become very dated, but the mm-hmm. font treatment or the name of the practice, that can live sort of the life of the practice with very minor modifications to make it an updated look.
Right.
It's when we get into icons and silhouettes of bodies and silhouettes of faces, and then you add a completely different division or product line to your practice, and the icon no longer fits mm-hmm. with anything else that you're doing. So I right. think that's very true. So I think spending more time on the font treatments of things and really identifying your practice by name as opposed mm-hmm. to an icon specifically.
So give me an idea, this branding process. You said, a practice may spend some upfront time when they start doing interviews, getting you whatever you need to really kind of get to know them mm-hmm. and understand who they are, their quote story. How long does it take? Number one, how long does it take for you or the practice to figure this process of creating a brand? How long does that take? And really, I've seen, some of these quote branding agency, they can be 20, 30. I've seen it as high as $50,000-$60,000 to create a brand. What should a practice look at investing when it comes to both time and money when it comes to developing their brand?
Well, the numbers that you just mentioned, those are probably more associated with very high-end agencies, like a Park Avenue agency or San Francisco or Beverly Hills kind of agency, where they've got, dozens and dozens of employees. And of course, they're trying to make a bottom line. Normally when you work with an individual branding specialist, like myself and my creative team, we're nowhere near that. We would say in hours, not weeks or months. I've seen agencies spend a full year developing a brand, which is ridiculous. For a private practice or even a group practice, we did a huge practice a couple of years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, that was part of the Emory Healthcare System. So it's a $4 billion organization. Yeah. But even for something like that, the entire project was probably under $10,000. And that was for that huge organization. So for mm-hmm. a private practice, it's a couple of thousand dollars to really delve in and do that, and then provide them with a final document that they could take to a website company or they could take somewhere else to have them deliver that. So I think it does not have to be expensive, but you do have to invest the time, your own personal time. Otherwise, you may as well forget about doing it.
No, I think... And that, I think, is reasonable. That is a small investment of something that you're going to get residual value, that's going to carry into everything that you do. And let's face it, you're spending a lot more money on the exposure, whether it's media, SEO, pay-per-click. You're spending a lot more money on the exposure. It's like buying a Super Bowl ad. They may spend $200,000 to produce that commercial, mm-hmm. but that one spot's going to cost them $2 million, for the 30 right. seconds.
Right.
It's worth putting that money into the message because it's that exposure is so expensive, mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but you reminded me of something that if physicians in particular would think about how consumers try to find them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that there's not a lot of thought given that we have, as humans, we have the tendency to think whatever we've put out there is of very high value, but it may not be of value how it's written or how they're talking about it, it may not be of value to the demographics that they're trying to attract to their practice.
Right.
And so I think you have to sort of get out of your own way in some instances and really start thinking about, I think you actually alluded to it at the very early stages, we are exposed to somewhere around 10, 15,000 ad messages a day, in some cases more, depending upon where you live. So your mind has to, so that you don't drive yourself crazy, you have to filter out everything that is not important to you and also not important to you right now. Because something could be of interest to you down the road, but if it's not right now, then you filter it out. You're not going to call on it. You're not going to click on it because there are too many other things that you're housing in your brain. So I think practices probably need to understand that a little better. Just because we think it's cool may not be what the consumer that they're trying to approach at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually talked to an ad agency out of San Diego, and their whole focus is on radio and billboards and so forth. And their whole principle, if you will, is that big and bold. Well, what happens if you're driving along 405 in San Diego and the millions of people that make that drive? Mm-hmm. Well, how many eyeballs hit that billboard that actually care? Whereas if you think about with the internet, it's so different. That's why website companies and SEO companies in particular have such a greater advantage. Because if I'm sitting at my computer and I decide I really want to get rid of love handles or I really want to get rid of my double chin, I am now looking for that and I'm typing that in. And so it's a whole different, I think the internet changed everything for marketing. And nothing that we do today was not impacted by the internet.
Yeah. And branding is absolutely no exception. In fact, it's probably even more so.
Right.
When it comes to marketing. You had mentioned, and I appreciate all this great insight because I'm not a brand, I'm not a brand person in terms of my marketing expertise. I'm more of the direct response, let's get in front of the right people, that kind of stuff. And building a brand was always kind of, it wasn't my strength. And I can say that. I love the fact that you have a much deeper understanding of that. And I've actually seen some of your work. And I can attest that, you understand when it comes to a practice. And when I talk to those, because I've actually talked to some of those practices, and they talk very differently about their practice and their brand, having worked with a branding agency or somebody that understands or makes them think about their brand.
Right.
They talk about their practice very differently.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. No, it is. They talk very differently. You had brought up in something that you said earlier, whether it affects your website, your loyalty programs and stuff like that. Branding is such a important thing about staying relevant, staying top of mind, and painting a picture. The concept of loyalty as it relates to brand, I'd like to talk a little bit about that. Once you start getting patients and yeah, they're familiar with who you are, what do you do to maintain, I'm seeing a lot of practices invest in these loyalty programs. A lot of cosmetic industries, vendors and stuff have really understood that developing a quote lifetime patient, that loyalty is, that's where you really do compound return on investment is on that. Talk to me a little bit about, you were one of the first people I knew that really kind of started developing loyalty programs and stuff like that. Where does that fit in today's, online marketing and in practices today?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great thought in terms of what practices need to do to develop better recurring revenue. Mm-hmm. Because the whole point, when you look at the frequent flyer program, For example, I'm a million miler on Alaska Airlines. I dream of going on another airline, if at all possible. And Starbucks, I'm a million miler there too.
Okay.
So, but in both cases, I would probably be a loyal consumer regardless, but I must say that I really appreciate the loyalty perks that come along with that. And so about 15, I think it's been at least 15 years ago, my creative team and I started developing loyalty programs for practices. And the whole point of those is to stimulate recurring revenue. I think the tragedy for a lot of plastic surgeons some years ago is they do a facelift and maybe a liposuction and, you know, maybe $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of procedures, and then lose that patient to a practice down the street for Botox and fillers and other things.
Right.
And the patient never even knew that those services were available with the doctor that did all of their work. And so practices didn't know how to introduce ongoing services to their surgery patients. And so that was one of the impetuses for us to create the loyalty program in the first place, to have an attractive presentation
right.
to give to a surgery patient, letting them know that once your surgery is completed, we're here to serve you in other areas. And so that's really how they started for us. And of course, Allergan was doing Brilliant Distinctions at the time. Their program has been around for a very long time. And so any of the loyalty programs that we created, we just rolled Brilliant Distinctions right into them.
Okay.
And recurring products that are sold today have some kind of a loyalty program.
Mm-hmm.
And you can marry all of those into one document that's branded to you. And that was the other thing that we felt. It's one thing for you to have a Brilliant Distinctions program, but so does every other doctor in
Absolutely.
Your
Absolutely. That was my next point. My next question was, for a practice that uses Brilliant Distinctions or any one of the other technology companies, they all offer, like you said, some loyalty, capabilities for practices to leverage. How does a practice, what do you do when you're consulting with a practice to somewhat differentiate between the other Brilliant Distinctions in all these other practices around town?
Right. Well, it all goes back to what our initial conversation was branding everything to the practice. So the loyalty program needs to be branded to the practice just like everything else. But let's talk about how do you set up a loyalty program?
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of confusion about that. And what takes the time is the mechanics of it. What are the levels of service that you want to provide and what level of discount are you willing to apply to those services and products? And we always found that if there was an initiation fee into a program, that it was stickier, that patients had some investment into the program. And for that, we would put together a series or set of perks and things that, of course, the practice is buying wholesale, but on the brochure and the loyalty program, it has a retail value. So the patient is getting something for their investment, and then everything else that you are adding to that, to the various, program that you want to offer are some discounts for that. Otherwise, what is the point of the investment that the patient is making? So they're doing this because, yes, they love you, but they're also getting a little something for that.
That's a great point, because I see some programs that are just, you just pay a little bit or you just get this discount or something. There is no upfront buy-in kind of thing. What would you say for the practices as well? I don't have patients that can really, drop hundreds of dollars or in some cases $1,000 on a loyalty program. What do you say to a practice? I don't have that kind of patience. I don't have those kind of patience.
Well, if they have patients that are buying cosmetic procedures from them, that are coming in for fillers and for products, they have the money for a loyalty program. I think that practices that don't think their patients can afford this are kidding themselves, because that's not true. They do. But there's so many ways of doing this. It really does need to meet the demographics of where the practice is located. If you are a Marina Del Rey or Huntington Beach or Beverly Hills practice, your clientele is going to be a little different than something that's in Encino or that is in Riverside, even though it's within a 20-30 mile drive, right. You are going to have a different sort of database and a different, point of buy-in. So those things are all factored into when you're developing your loyalty program. You can't look at one that was done for a Grant Stevens, for example, or somebody that is very, very high profile who has, you know, clients that are at a very different economic bracket. So each program is developed and identified around your demographics and the services that you provide.
Maybe another layer onto that. Where does the staff fit in into rollout, into the execution of a loyalty program?
I think it's so critical to anything that a practice is doing. In fact, that's another chapter I'm writing right now, even on something goal setting for physicians. If they don't include their staff in that, they're losing such valuable resources. But when you look at doing something, rolling something out like a program, such as a loyalty program, your staff involvement and buy-in is so essential that without that, we won't even work with a practice that doesn't include their staff, because it's doomed to failure.
Right.
And in fact, if they don't get staff buy-in, they could be off by miles. I guarantee you that the staff knows far more about the buying habits of their patients than any physician that I have ever worked with. So absolutely, you have to have that involvement. And further, beyond that, the staff needs training with how to introduce it so that they don't feel like they're selling something. Right. I think that's the whole point. This is a gift with purchase kind of thing. And so understanding the language that you need to use, the dialogue, that's all part of a sales package that the staff needs to understand how to present it.
Yeah. And I think the idea of, you know, that mentality of quote selling something, as opposed to really being excited about offering value or, you know, the benefits of it, not so much the cost. And I think that's where you kind of pointed out that these patients can afford it. If they're coming in and paying disposable dollars on surgery, on cosmetics, on, you know, aesthetic services, they can afford these things. And half the time it's our own head trash. It's our own head talking us, basically negotiating with ourselves.
Yeah.
We negotiate with ourselves and say, oh, they're not going to do that. And I've never even talked to them yet. You know, so.
Bill, on the staff issue, you made me think of something that I think is especially important to this discussion. When you're creating the loyalty program and you are including your staff in this process, so they are helping guide the process of what the practice is ultimately going to offer to their patient base. If the discounts aren't valuable, or if the staff does not believe that this is a good deal for patients, they will never sell this.
Right.
And I see this, it's so fascinating. I have seen a few practices come out with what they think would be a good percentage, and they'll offer something like a 5% discount. Yeah. If that's where you're coming from, this is not the product for you. You need to step away from this, because that will do more damage for your practice than to propel it. Because from the patient's perspective, you look cheap. Mm-hmm. So you really have to think about this from a psychological perspective. If you want people to get excited and buy more, then you have to make it worth their while. And it needs to look like there's really some value and that you've actually thought about them. At least that should be the perception of your loyalty program.
You know, when you first brought the idea of, you know, loyalty programs, when I was first introduced to loyalty programs, largely from you, you know, what I found interesting that I said, if a practice embraces this, what they will do is not only just will they offer a loyalty program, they'll change the way they think in that practice. Mm-hmm. They change the relationship that they have with their patients,
right,
and how they speak to them, and know that this is not a, I'm having surgery and probably never going to see these people again. I think the mentality when you implement these types of things changes, you know, how people in the practice think, and it changes the dialogue of the interactions they have with patients. And I think that that more than anything is, as much as there's value in the program itself, it's changing the tonality, the conversations, the relationships that they have with their patients, mainly because I have this loyalty program as somewhat of a crutch to do that. You know, and I've always thought that, you know, this whole loyalty program is such a valuable thing, even above the marketing, is it just changes the, mm-hmm. you know, how the practice feels about themselves and the relationships that they have with their patients.
Absolutely. Well, it elevates the customer service.
Exactly. Customer service is really the word that needs to be used
here. It really elevates that. And practices have experienced this for a long time, where patients are bringing them cookies or cake mm-hmm. or flowers post-procedure.
Great point. Yeah.
So when you start looking at rewarding them for this, you're now seeing these patients a lot more.
Yeah.
So they have a friendship with the practice. It's very interesting when you see the dynamics of that change.
Yeah. And that's when you first brought that, you know, the loyalty concepts, you know, when I was first being introduced to it, that's the first thing that came to mind. And I said, man, that can really change the dynamics of a practice.
And
that's what I thought was such a kind of eye-opening thing, is that a loyalty program could do more than just generate a few bucks.
Right.
It can change how you think.
Good point. Excellent point, Bill. Yeah. I'm going to write that down.
Well, hey, I got it from you. So, hey, is there anything else? I would say, if you're, you know, what would be the, you know, you talked about the structure and getting this stuff done. I'd like to end with one last question. What would be the biggest pitfall or the biggest failure? Why these, because I've seen in some practices that, you know, we have one, but we really don't do much with it. It doesn't really do much. What's the difference or pitfalls from a practice that is got a loyalty program that is hitting on all cylinder is wildly successful, and one that is not successful or even just mildly successful? What would you say would be the one thing that would be different?
You know, Bill, over the years, I don't know how many podiums you and I have shared, but it's been a fair number over all these years. And I'm sure you've heard me say this a million times. It's never the what, it's always the who. It's who is designated with driving this in the practice and is the cheerleader or the champion and is excited about it. Because as we were talking earlier, I was thinking about the practices that have failed with this. And there's not that many, but the practices that have failed, it's been very consistent every single time. Very lackluster excitement from the doctors.
Oh.
Could care less about it. Right. Not really, don't really fully get it. Feel like, okay, we got to do it. Let's just do something.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, attitudes filter down. They don't filter up. So when there's no enthusiasm from the founder or the mm-hmm. practice head, then the attitudes moving down the practice are also the same.
Yeah.
And so if it's lackluster in that regard, the whole program is lackluster and it never catches on. So I would say that's the most important. Secondarily, I've seen programs that are way too complex.
Oh, okay.
They've got 35 charts and they've got, you know, all different segments of this thing. It makes your head hurt when you look at it. This has to be simple, stupid. It's got to be really simple. You can look at it and you go, well, this is a no-brainer. If I invest $500, I get X number of savings for the rest of the year. If I spend 700, I get this. If I spend 1,000, I get this big discount. And that's exciting. So, I mean, it's all in the details, making it simple, compelling, and having the enthusiasm that it needs to drive anything.
Oh, that, you know, great points, Dan. And I think in the day-to-day, and you're right, we've shared the podium a number of times. and let's face it, we always need to be reminded of the things that are foundational, because there's so many things going, as you said, thousands of messages that we get all the time. And sometimes we can be distracted from the really the things that are the foundational of success in almost anything that we do. So
definitely.
Great words. Hey, Dana, I want to thank you again for all of your wisdom in our talk today. You've given me almost a full hour of your time. And I know you've thought about this before we even got on, on our show. Thank you so much. You're always a breath of fresh air when I chat with you. You always put a smile on my face, and I still have that Starbucks mug you gave me. On our- I still have that. I have that with me almost every morning, as long as it's clean.
Well, good. I'd hate to have you drinking Starbucks out of a dirty cup.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you again, Dana.
My pleasure.
And all your wisdom. And I look forward to seeing you at the next meeting.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us for the MedShark Insider with Bill Fukui. Join us next week for another dive into all things medical marketing. All episodes can be streamed at www.medsharkdigital.com/medshark-insider.